this week on the Inside Flap.
And when East Germany got permission from Moscow to put up the wall, Ulbricht, who was the head of state at the time, he'd already been purchasing barbed wire from around the world in small enough quantities to not get anyone suspicious. Wow. He'd already been prefabricating cement blocks outside the city. And in one morning, that barbed wire's up, and within days, the cement started getting rolled in.
And I didn't notice the orange cone.
Oh, there was an orange cone.
These kids are good kids.
They are good kids.
I didn't notice the orange cone.
How do you not see the orange cone?
On this circle, 95% cut out. I take my left foot, goes directly onto this circle. And immediately, the other 5% snaps off, and I plummet.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my slight right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And resting comfortably. I don't know how comfortable he is. Actually, he always has his feet up. He can scoot those things further.
Up.
He's got his feet down on the ground, firmly planted on the ground. And he's got a hat on today. What is that hat?
I think it's St. Louis. It's a balloon.
Oh, he's got a St. Louis
hat. From the balloon race.
It almost looks like a Buffalo Bills hat.
It's a subtle St. Louis hat.
That is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Welcome to episode 245 of the Inside Flap Book Podcast. Great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us. Got a great show for you today. We're joined by best-selling author Catherine Ray, award-winning author of several novels, including The London House. Her new book out now is The Berlin Letters. The Berlin Letters. It's really good. And we'll have our chat with Catherine in just a bit. But first, well, we finally wrapped up, and I'm so glad we wrapped up our four-run show of Urinetown on Sunday as we record this on a Tuesday night. And what a run it was. Extra special for me because not only did I get to play my trombone in the orchestra like I did last year for Chicago, but this year, a special guest trombonist joined me up there. And that was, of course, my daughter, our daughter, Sylvia.
You can say my, too.
That's true. Now, we were the only trombone players in the 42-piece orchestra, and we just had a blast doing that. Now, initially, I kind of guilted her into joining me, telling, you know, I was like, come on, you're going away to college. This is the last chance.
Was guilt, Andrew. It was laid on so thick.
Well, and she didn't even want to do it.
No, she had no desire to do it.
She did not want to do it
you
at all.
You applied the poor me, poor dad, I'm going to miss you, you're going away.
I laid it on very thick. Yes.
So I'm the father of a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I've got to say, sometimes in order to get that kid out of his room.
True.
You basically have to.
Yes.
Well, you got to use every trick in the book.
Yeah. So especially the age that your teenager is.
Yeah.
It was so hard back then.
She's like, all right, fine. I'll do one show with you. And I said, okay, great. But you got to get up to rehearse with us first. And then once she got up there at a rehearsal and we got her
in
the space.
It took a couple rehearsals for her to really get into it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, maybe it did. You're right. Yeah. Well, when she was a little more comfortable playing the music.
I think that could have been it, yeah.
And at first, she was only going to play like at one show. But we got her to, she's like, oh yeah, this is a lot of fun. I'm going to do all four shows with you. And what was even more special than that was that this was Keith Oxman's last year at the school. Now, he is a somewhat of a Denver legend. In fact, I Googled just to see how much of a legend he is. Best jazz musicians in Denver. And, of course, Keith Oxman's name on all the lists. We've gone to see him a couple of times, the local space here in Dazzle.
Let me say this about Keith. I personally find him very intimidating because I've never had a conversation with him. I've seen him play jazz.
Right, yeah.
And I've just observed him directing orchestras for the last 3 years. He looks so intimidating.
He's very tall. We've seen him on stage doing his thing with his jazz combo.
Yes, he appears to be brilliant.
He's put out, like, I don't know how many CDs. Like, he dropped off
a ton of CDs.
He gave us, after Chicago, like 15 CDs.
Yeah.
He's published he's very unknown number of albums. He is an intimidating guy. In fact, when was it? It was...
Sylvia said he's the nicest guy.
He is.
You want to meet, though.
He really is so nice. Yeah. He's so funny. He told me on Sunday that it was his 92nd performance that he had led the orchestra for a musical at East High School.
Wow.
92nd. Whoa. I said, well, Keith, well, you got to come. And he's going in. He's retiring this year.
That's crazy.
I said, Keith, you got to do two more shows. That's four shows to get to 96 and then four more to get to 100. I said, you got to do 100. He looks at me. He goes, Dave. And he's like shaking his head. I can't put up with this shit anymore. And now what he meant by this shit was, I'm not exactly sure, but there's a lot of, you know, I mean.
It's teenagers.
It's teenagers.
It's teenagers. You know? Mm. We're all in this room, the parent of a teenager.
Right.
We know.
And he's got a lot of talkers in this orchestra. So he had a lot of, guys, quiet down. Guys, quiet down. I had to even lay into a couple of orchestra members myself.
Yeah. And it's not like East has like a huge musical culture necessarily, right?
Oh, no. We have a great musical. He's got a great jazz band. They write their own music. Mm. They don't have a marching band. I think that's what you're thinking of. They don't have a marching band.
Yeah.
But no, he's built an incredible program there. He's got some very talented musicians there. And he has them write their own music, which is very special. And he takes them out and they get to perform their music.
Oh, that's nice.
They do not have a... I remember the first time I met Keith, the very first thing I ever said to him, unfortunately, was, and this was when Sylvia was big in the marching band in Littleton, I said I didn't know who he was, and I was like, hey, you do a marching band?
Oh.
He just looked at me with disgust.
Because like, he's a jazz guy.
He just shook his head.
Yeah.
And I think he said, I said, no.
I can't picture him doing
marching
band.
Hell no.
He comes off as so erudite and elegant. There is no way that guy is doing marching band.
He's also a big chess guy. He goes to tournaments in Vegas and plays like these big
tournaments. Not surprised.
No, not surprised at all. And I was
IQ goes down like 20 points when I stand next to him.
He's played with Buddy Rich. He's played with, Curtis Fuller many times. He's played with all the legends.
Wow.
And I was, I'm proud to say, I was his official Coke supplier, his Coke dealer, as he liked to point out. Of course, we're talking Coca-Colas. I kept him in full supply of Coca-Cola during the run. And then Friday night, so after school on Friday, you know, we go to school till like 4:30, and then it's just a couple of hours before he has his musicians come. So I get a phone call on Friday after school.
Before the production.
Before the production, right. And my phone rings and I see it's Keith Oxman calling me. And I get it. Like, I'm, like you said, Laura, you're intimidated by him.
Yeah.
I just get excited.
Oh.
I get excited. Yeah. So I say, ooh, Keith is calling me. Yeah, Andrew.
So you want to go camping with him and leave the wives behind? Is that what you're saying, Dave?
That's what I'm hearing.
No. He calls me. And
I cannot picture Keith Oxman camping.
And I said, hey, Keith, what's happening? No, Keith is not doing any camping.
No.
I said, hey, Keith, what do you need? He goes, Dave, you got any food down there? Oh, no, first, like, are you at school? I'm like, yeah. He said, you got any food down there? I said, well, Keith, I got peanut butter and jelly. I can make you a sandwich. He goes, no, that's all right. And then he just hangs up. He says, I'll talk to you later. Hangs up. I said, okay. 3 seconds later, my phone rings again. It's Keith Oxman.
Huh.
Hey, Keith, how you doing? I think I'm going to go across the street and get something to eat. You want anything? I said, no, I'm good. And then there's a pause.
Yeah.
And there's like a pause. It's so long. I do one of those deals where you pull it off because I don't want to say, hello, are you there? I like pull it off my ear.
I was talking to somebody else today that was a long pauser on the phone.
I pull it off to see. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, I'm still connected. Put it back up and I hear, I think I'm just going to take a nap up here.
Oh, he doesn't know if he's hungry or tired.
Yeah, in his office.
Yeah.
I said, all right. And I guess he took a nap like right up to when the musicians arrived, because I had one of his kids come up to me and they're like, Dave, where are the Cokes? Keith needs a Coke. Oh. Oxman needs a Coke.
I said,
all right, I got it.
That's really funny.
But it just so, he's such a great guy. He's an icon, a Denver icon, a local legend. He's done, like,
it's
he's
weird
done
to me that
92
he's nice.
Performances.
Because somebody
he's
like
super
that,
nice.
I feel like shouldn't be nice.
He's so funny. As we were, like, the night before closing night, and closing night, Laura, you came, and Andrew, you were kind enough to come
yeah,
to
Andrew
see the show,
really
too.
Yeah, Andrew was really nice of you to come.
It was very nice of you. You brought down Steve and Marilyn to see the show, and that was great. But the night before closing night, I said to, and you know, when you have the last show at the high school, we always honor all the seniors. And so we all get up there and we say a few words about each senior. And I like to be prepared with like a little joke and then something nice to say.
Anecdote, yeah.
And so I'm like, I said to Deb, and it's me, Deb, and Keith are standing around after Saturday night's performance. I said, all right, Deb, can you give me the list of the seniors that I need to talk about. It's like, Dave, why do you need that? Why do you need that? I said, well, I just want to have something prepared to talk about. And Keith turns to me, he goes, wait, so what you said last year was prepared? and I busted out laughing. And of course, Deb waited until Sunday afternoon to give me the list of seniors
that
I
had to
talk about.
She knew what she was
about.
Doing.
So I had to run around and ask other kids to what I could say about them.
So I thought it was funny. So it was, you know, great production, obviously an amazing set.
Mm-hmm.
And especially looking to see if any kids are like going to fall off the set or fall between
that
the
was
set.
Well, that was the thing to watch.
The,
thing
yeah. that you
this
keep
was
an eye
the
on.
Thing to watch.
And I'll put pictures of the set, but we had built, so we built two platforms and that were two levels, a lower level and upper level. They were 7 feet high. And plus, they had a backdrop on both of them, so it went, and you know, the backdrop went another 7 feet in the air, and they were 8 feet square, and they were both on wheels, so the crew would roll them around, and they had a front and the back, so they would have the back facing towards the audience, and that was a certain scene, and then the front facing, but this crew was moving them all around, and at one point, we had McGregor, when the two we called them cubes. They're cubes, 8 foot square cubes.
He plays Bobby Strong.
And played one of the leads. And we had him, and the two cubes were together, and he's up on the upper platform, seven feet up in the air. He's straddling the platform. Well, someone missed the cue on our crew, and they started to pull the cubes apart.
I saw a video of that. It's and on East High School's.
I'm glad.
It's on East Theater Company's TikTok.
Oh boy, I'm glad they put that on social media.
It's
so he's doing. Is he doing the splits?
No, he jumps and he jumps into the arms of the actor that's on the other side, and then he kind of stays in character and he gives him a huge hug.
Yeah, it wasn't during a performance; it was during a rehearsal.
I thought it was because you could hear.
I think it was.
I could hear what sounded like an audience go, oh.
Maybe it was during it. I don't know. I heard it, but I couldn't see it.
He was dressed like it was the performance.
Well, we did have many dress rehearsals. Oh, you know, it might have been in front of the middle school that we invited.
Yeah, I heard a
But luckily, he has great cat-like instincts. But I kept worried, and the stairs that we'll put pictures up on our Facebook page, The Inside Flap, but we had to build these curved stairs that I've talked about on the show. And I would sit there and watch, because the one closest to me was very wobbly. Let's just say it was a wobble to the left and to the right. And they would run up this thing. And we built, because the railings had a curve, they would not support your weight. And I was always screaming, get off the railings! Get off the railings! And then the actors later on would say, Dave, how about you build some staircases with some railings that support you? I said, well, how about you look up and figure out how to build wooden railings that curve that will also support support weight and do it on a budget of a high school musical? How about you do that? It was my always retort. But I would watch that. But no, luckily, nobody got hurt. The closest thing to anybody got hurt was this. When we were building, and you guys both saw the show, of course, so you knew that we built the stage way out once again, like, you know, 20 feet out and huge 40 feet wide, whatever it is. We extended the stage to get closer to the audience. And it's like about 4 feet high off the ground there. Well, we put in three, because they're sewers, these characters go down into the sewers, we built three manhole covers.
Oh, yeah.
And they come up and, you know, people can pop down into the thing. Well, when they were building them, they're cutting out the hole. And I guess something happened when they were about 95% of the way through cutting the hole out.
Oh, no.
That they stopped.
Oh, no.
And I'm on stage, and I've noticed a couple of kids over there standing on the platform. So I march across the platform towards these kids. I don't remember why, but I remember walking across to go to tell them something. And I didn't notice the orange cone.
Oh, there was an orange cone.
These kids are good kids.
They are good kids.
I didn't notice the orange cone.
How do you not see the
orange
cone?
On this circle, 95% cut out. I step. I take my left foot, goes directly onto this circle. And immediately, the other 5% snaps off, and I plummet straight down the 4 to 5 feet straight down. Without, I mean, I was like suspended in midair. It shocked me. I fell down.
Wow.
My back kind of hit like the stage.
You could have been really hurt.
Well, let me tell you, not me. Let me tell you, when I looked to
there
my left.
There were people underneath
there. There was Jack, was a high school senior, directly to the left of where I landed. Had he been 2 feet, 1 foot to his right, who knows what could have happened.
You came crashing down from the heavens.
Yes. And like I always like to say, we don't talk about OSHA.
Yes.
At school, we call it that government organization.
Yeah.
But sometimes, like when we were at strike today, I had all the actors wearing hard hats. We had them in hard hats.
Yeah, glasses.
And safety glasses and all that stuff. But man, that was on me. That was 100% on me.
How do you miss the cone?
I don't know. But when you're in charge of, and you got like 30 kids running around.
That's true.
All with power tools.
I couldn't handle that. With power tools,
drills, hammers. People are sawing. People are cutting. People are building. Kids are up on scaffolding or whatever. Yeah. They're up in the balcony hanging lights. There is so much going on. And you are one person and you're just move. And you're not thinking. But we got through it without anybody getting hurt.
Thank goodness. Well, when Andrew and I saw it, we saw one kid. He like stepped on the crack between these two pieces that move.
Oh, that was Graham, right?
Yeah.
And so he was feeling for it with his foot.
And it's the second level. He's up on the second level. Uh-huh. We're all looking at him.
Yeah, because sometimes they don't come together as neatly.
No, they don't.
They always should.
And what's interesting with Graham is, he's typically sitting at a desk, which straddles both of these things.
Yes, it straddles
The desk
it's
is
weird.
Cut in half.
It's weird.
So it's like, boy.
That was Deb's idea. I don't know.
Oh, I always wondered, because it takes me out of the production because I'm thinking about how they're sitting there.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't agree with that.
So I had a laugh because basically when Deb comes out and she's on her soapbox.
Yeah.
And she's basically giving her... her spin to the play and why it's important and all the different things. But she unabashedly is up there just spouting her, I'll call it rhetoric.
Sure.
You know, and it's just like, she is just in your face with that stuff, you know?
Yeah. And it was a long speech. Sylvie and I every night would look at our phones to see what time we actually got to start playing the beginning of the show, and the last night was 18 minutes past.
Whoa. Oh, they started late last night, though.
2:18.
Yeah.
2:18.
They started late that day.
Saturday night was 7:17.
Oh, we started on time on Saturday night.
No.
Yep. Interesting.
But that's how that goes. Anyway, Laura, how has your week been?
Oh, you know, it's been good. It was just the highlight was seeing you guys play together. I went to a Saturday night performance and then the Sunday matinee. And once again, you know, East Auditorium is...
Oh, it's hot.
It's like the surface of the sun in there.
It's so hot.
I can't... Have you guys ever taken a thermometer and measured how hot it is?
No, we should, though.
I'd like to know.
Yeah.
Because I got so overheated that I couldn't cool down even that night.
The ventilation clearly is not very good in there.
No, it's a building built in the 1920s. It's a 100-year-old building. And,
it's 100 years old this year.
It's awful. Yeah, it's awful.
And I wouldn't say that it was... hot. I mean, it was a little warm.
Oh no, it was hot, Andrew.
Well, it was warm, but there was no circulation.
It was like an oven to me.
And we even, before the show starts, as soon as we get there 2 hours beforehand, we open up all the doors along the side there, and we open up, there's windows on either side. We open up all the windows to get some cross ventilation going there, and it cools it down. And then, right before the audience comes in, we shut all the doors. And
then,
by intermission, it's right back to being
90
degrees.
That you have to sit in
are
like
old wooden seats.
They're old and wooden.
Yeah.
So you say that.
Yes.
But I much prefer these old wooden seats.
I do not.
Than like the folding chairs and stuff.
Oh, so like some of the you mean in the black box?
Well, not just
those,
the black
those
box.
Those are nice.
Those were like nice.
Those
padded.
Are real nice.
But when they did, they flipped the stage and the stage
became
where the audience sat.
Like the metal ones or something?
Oh, like those metal chairs and stuff like that. So yeah. I have no problem with those theater chairs.
I spent 5 hours in the folding metal chair total. So it's folding wooden chair from what felt like the 1800s.
On senior night when we came out and gave all the awards.
Yeah, so I spent 3 hours on senior night, 2 hours on Saturday night. Yeah. So it was a total of 5 hours in incredible heat. It's like being in Arizona.
Well, multiply that times three.
Like,
and that's how long I've been
don't
in there,
know how
terrible
the actors do it. It is so hot.
And those speeches, after I gave my first senior speech, I turned around because we had a bunch of seniors to thank, and we had the parents stay, and anybody who wants to hear the senior speeches, they stay. And after I gave my first speech, I'm going back to the box to grab the flower for the person that she's going to thank. And she goes, "Dave, let's shorten these speeches." But I thought, Andrew, tell me what you think about this line. When I was talking about the stairs we built, I was thanking Foster for working on them. And, I said, listen, these stairs have had more work done to them than Kim Kardashian. Am I right?
So I like it, yeah.
Well, that was a good
one. It was good.
And the drummer gave me a little...
oh, did he?
A little... She. A little,
oh, she, sorry.
A little... ba-da-bing.
Ba-da-bum, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, so I love seeing you two up there. It was great. You were the only two trombones. You're in town. Like, if you haven't seen it, it's a good musical.
It's a fantastic
musical. I can see why it won Tony Awards. The music's really good. It's funny. There's some great parts for the actors.
Yep.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Andrew, how have you
been? Wait, hold on.
Oh, what?
You're bearing the lead here. Oh. Are you not going to mention the fact that you were in the New York Times?
Oh, yes.
Come on.
I forgot all about
it.
We'll
put a link to it on our on the Facebook page
that's
as
right.
well. But yes, Laura Medicus.
I was quoted.
Quoted in the New York Times, and a link to your website.
Which is very important.
Yeah, and that's what you want to have. Yeah.
Yes.
Katie said to say congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that was a big deal. I wasn't sure, Andrew, I was interviewed for it over a month ago.
Right.
And I wasn't sure if I was going to make it or if I was going to get cut. And she sent it to me. I made it. It was very exciting.
It's an article all about hidden rooms.
Secret doors.
Secret doors.
Mm-hmm.
And,
So now you have to start charging New York prices here in Denver?
I need to start charging New York prices.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, I can maybe quote myself sometime.
It's like when the Yankees come to town.
Drop names.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, Andrew, how have you been?
So, it's interesting. So I've been out of work 6 weeks now.
Oh, really?
Yep. So February 1st was my last day.
Wow, time goes by.
Yeah, boy.
Huh.
There's always so much to do.
And yet he's over here telling me how busy, so busy he couldn't watch the end of the Oscars.
Yeah, I don't know what you were doing on Sunday night.
I was down on the baby's exercising.
Oh, good for you.
So you say you're exercising, not you're busy.
Well,
so
one man's exercise.
He loves to say how
so last week, I took Peter to the annual animatronics convention in St. Louis.
Oh.
Is this like a big nationwide convention?
It is.
Is this like the creme de la creme?
Does it go to different cities every year?
I think it's always in St. Louis.
Like the Super Bowl.
Right. So... St. Louis in the middle of the country, it really is not a bad spot to have a convention.
But St. Louis in early March, what's the weather like there?
It was actually quite nice.
Oh, that's good.
Rains.
Yeah, and but it rains a lot there, though, right?
What I will tell you is it's interesting when you like leave Denver, go to St. Louis, right? 2-hour flight, but it's full spring there. I mean, the trees are in full blossom. I mean, it's like...
We get a very late spring here
and
up in this altitude,
You know, and I will say that about anything, whether it comes to reading books or doing this, but sometimes, I mean, you have to change perspectives, you know, I mean, and... The book I'm reviewing this week is definitely a change of perspectives, but you know,
you read An Amish Romance then.
And so, let's see. So Dave's got me speechless here for a second. So anyways,
he was picturing that shirtless Amish guy.
So it's called,
we know what he was thinking about.
It's called Trans World. And you know, I mean, how this convention is called Trans World, I have no idea.
Why is it called Trans
World? I have no
Wait
idea.
Wait a second. Trans World?
Yeah. Huh. Because that's not what I would expect.
I mean, I would get some people buying tickets to that and not expect
be
to
be very
see a
disappointed
bunch of,
with the animatronics.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyways, it's called Trans World, and it is, you know, it's Halloween stuff.
Here it is, Trans World's Halloween and attractions.
Yeah, and they also have lighting out the wazoo for like Christmas and stuff like that. Hmm. And, you know, the Denver, Colorado has one of the best animatronic manufacturers in the country, probably the world. Is called Distortions from Greeley, Colorado. They have been pioneers, and they had just a huge, amazing, stand or display this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, they basically went all out.
Wow. Is it at the convention center there?
It's called American Convention Center. Mm. And there's 25-foot tall animatronics. Wow. I mean, it is...
What kind of people go to these?
You know, it's all kinds of people. I mean,
like people who own like the Reinke Brothers, people like that who own like costume shops.
Didn't see the Reinke Brothers this year.
Okay.
Doesn't mean they weren't there, but we didn't see them.
Okay.
But I think people that are involved in selling or buying animatronics.
Okay.
I would say people that run Halloween attractions.
Oh.
Like 13th Floor.
Yeah.
Okay. So
Shacktober.
Big Halloween.
Sylvia and I saw in Longs houses. Beach.
Yeah, there's probably right. somebody from Shacktober.
Shacktober, yeah.
Shacktober there, but you know, and so what I would say probably one of the big things with Halloween now is all these different venues that put on the scares, like the haunts or the scares.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just
it's
doing
big
that.
Big business.
And even Reinke Brothers.
Business, yeah.
I mean, that's where they make all their money.
I love their haunted house.
Yeah. Is basically their haunted
so
house.
So much fun.
Oh, yeah. What a great job they do.
Yeah. A lot house. Of fun.
So, but you know, so Peter's there. And we spent 2 days there. Like last year it was 1 day.
Wow.
This year was two days.
That's a lot, Andrew.
Now, Dave, Peter criticized me that we're only there for 2 days, Dad. We should be there for all 4 days. He's guilt tripping me on this.
Wow.
But, you know, it's not like this convention is enormous, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's hundreds, maybe 1,000 exhibitors. I don't know. But after you've walked around for,
you know,
there's only so much you can take.
You can see
and that's
them all.
It.
Yeah.
You know, but we spent 2 full days there, and I'm still getting guilt tripped by this 12-year-old. as far as not spending more time there.
That's really funny.
As far as
what
like,
is he like? Has he talked about like for a living, like doing that kind of thing?
He does.
I would hope that he does that.
I mean,
the boy owns over 100 animatronics.
I feel like this is his calling in life.
Yeah. And so let's just say we've already worked on several projects since he got back. From there, like you know, just in terms of certain things,
does that mean? Certain projects.
Well, he buys animatronics and they're different things, and then he wants to modify them. So we've already sort of modified.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Basically, modified a few things, and then you know, I don't know. It's so it is.
Well, it is Trans World. So is he like modifying like the?
You're not going there. Okay. Not going there. Right. So the thing is, Peter's like only 12 years old, but he is a big kid, size 11 and a half.
He is
wide
tall.
Wide shoes.
Yeah. He's a big guy.
And I know because I had to buy him a new pair of sneakers.
Wow.
But I don't know if I can really refer to a size 11 and a half wide shoe as a sneaker.
Wow.
Just doesn't seem.
Wow.
Just doesn't seem right. And
I don't believe I've ever seen him in anything other than Crocs.
The kid hasn't even hit his growth spurt yet.
Wow.
So it's like, so we're hanging out with these kids. And after spending a day with these kids, I'm like, how old are you, by the way? Oh, I'm 17. And he's like, so how old are you, Peter? appears like I'm 12, and the kid's just like,
like the same size.
Oh yeah, yeah. Wow. Peter might actually have been taller. Wow. Like taller than this kid. Mike, he will be taller than me this year.
Yeah, I think he will. For sure. Yeah.
But that's not saying much.
Well, right? Yeah. No. He needs to be taller than Katie is what he needs to be.
Well, and that will happen. But
yeah.
You know, but it's great to see the creativity there from the exhibitors, from some of the guests that are there.
I bet.
Really a great community of people as well. And who knows? Maybe Peter will have a career in this stuff.
Now, the real question is how many animatronics are being shipped to your house right now as we speak?
You know, yeah, I'm so naive. I didn't even think about it.
No animatronics.
Okay.
None?
But we did purchase three. We purchased four things.
Okay.
We purchased Mini Gilbert. We purchased...
What is Mini Gilbert?
We purchased full-size Gilbert.
Oh.
He's sort of like a demon pumpkin. Googling it isn't going to do you any good. Oh. Unless you look for Jimmy's props are from North Carolina.
Oh.
Gilbert.
That's a lot to Google.
Oh, that's too much.
So it's like a horror pumpkin.
Oh.
So we got Mini Gilbert, regular-size Gilbert. Then he bought I think it's a 28-inch tall blue alien.
Wow.
And then... there was a third thing he purchased, but I can't really remember. A fourth thing he purchased, but I can't really remember what the fourth what the fourth thing is. But he, you know, he had his budget, and he believed.
Well, maybe it was that Vincent Price T-shirt you gave me.
That was just for you.
Okay, yeah, well, thank you.
I was looking for the perfect blend of Halloween and theater.
Yeah,
it was good.
Yeah, it was a good one. Yep. The it says that this Transworld. Attraction show, Halloween, whatever. It's been going on for 12 years in St. Louis.
Mm. And it's a great, honestly, it's a great location.
Looks like a great show.
We can stay.
If you're into that, yeah.
We can stay with family in it. And it's, you know, it's not expensive. Like, it's $99 for a four-day pass. I wish they sold a single-day pass so that, you know, more people would go if they could just buy a one-day pass.
Yeah, one day.
I feel like they should mount some of those animatronics up on the arch. You know,
yeah. That'd be fun.
Yeah,
have them up there, a bunch of vampires.
I've never been to. I think that's a state I've actually never been to. I've never been to Missouri.
It is the Show Me State.
I know, never been there.
Now, speaking of horror scenarios, have you ever been up in the St. Louis Arch?
I've never been to Missouri. Yeah,
that is a horrific experience. Andrew and I have.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you're in a tin can.
That's awful.
Honestly, it's like a can of tuna. Where you're crammed in there like a person crammed into a little tuna can. I mean, seriously, there's no windows, and this thing has to wind its way all the way to the top.
Wow.
You know, and not only is it bad enough that you got to get in it, well, in the beginning, well, when you're at the arch, it's like, well, the only way down is you got to get back in that tin. You got to get back in that can.
You look at a tiny window that's scratched and
like the Statue of Liberty or something.
And you're in this little tin can with other tourists who've been sitting in the summer heat in line or standing in line outside to get in the tin can. So you all have BO. It's just the worst experience.
Yeah, I mean it is. You know, and at the time it was like amazing. Technological breakthrough 100 years ago or whatever. Not so much.
Now it's like those wooden seats at East.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's get on with it, shall we? We have a great guest for you. Catherine Ray joins the show. Her new book is The Berlin Letters. I read this book, really enjoyed it. It is some excellent historical fiction. This is a story told in two separate timelines. The first timeline is in the 1980s. Where we meet Louisa. She is a code breaker for the CIA. One day, she discovers that the father that she thought was dead for many, many years, she never met her father. She finds out that not only is he alive, but he is in a prison in Germany.
Hmm.
And getting him out becomes a priority for her. In the other timeline, we go back to 1961, the day the Berlin Wall goes into effect, and we follow Luis's father from back then and what happens to him after his wife, who is of course Luis's mother. Well, the day that the Berlin Wall goes into effect, Luis's mother passes Luisa over a fence as she's still just a little tiny baby, passes her over a fence to her grandparents on that fateful day, and before her mother can climb over to be with her daughter, she is stopped by a Russian soldier. This book tells the story of the Berlin Wall in a fascinating manner. I love both timelines and learning about an event in history I really didn't know a whole lot about. This is excellent, thrilling, exciting stuff, and it was a lot of fun chatting with Catherine. So here that conversation is for you right now.
I'm in Lake Forest, Illinois, which is just north of Chicago.
Yeah, that's a famous suburb of Chicago, I feel like.
It sort of is. Notorious and famous and all sorts of stuff. I think F. Scott Fitzgerald was inspired to write The Great Gatsby here.
Wow.
Oh, very good.
You got that's cool. Set here, but he was staying here when he got the idea for the story and
Wow.
I know.
That's a good one.
I love that, yeah.
Is that do you guys have Frank Lloyd Wright stuff up there?
Well, we do. We have a couple houses, but the real place of Frank Lloyd Wright is down in Hyde Park.
Oh, okay.
North of the city.
Okay.
Near the University of Chicago.
Okay, yeah.
That's cool. A huge hub of his. Yeah. Wow. What about you all? Where are you from?
We're in Littleton, Colorado right now, so it's a suburb of Denver. Yeah.
Okay, nice.
We're all suburban here. We're suburban, you know. Well, let's talk about your book, which is not about the suburbs. Listen, I love this book so much. This is, yes, indeed, clap, clap, The Berlin Letters. This is a tale, listen, this is a tale of barbed wire, Blockbuster Video, and chocolate cake. Catherine, what was it? And you know, a lot more than just that, but those were the three things that really stood out for me. What was it that inspired you to write this book?
You know, a few things did. At first, my book prior to this was called A Shadow in Moscow. It was about two young women. One worked for the CIA, one worked for MI6 in Cold War Moscow, sort of a spy thriller. And I learned so much about the Cold War era. And it really struck me that the Berlin Wall itself is this iconic symbol, along with being a real impediment to family togetherness.
Just a little bit.
Right. Down the center of Berlin. And so that really struck me. And then in looking up pictures, another thing, looking at pictures, you know, the day it went up, there are these two pictures that are often not put together. But I realized that the woman's clothing was the same and the man's clothing was the same. And these were two pictures taken like one after the other. And in one picture, she's holding the baby. And in the other picture, he's holding the baby. Wow. And that struck me. Wow. And then I also ran across the Venona Project, which was a code-breaking project from 1943 all the way until 1980. Top secret CIA project. About breaking into by 1943, they were not old, but in 1980, old Soviet codes and gleaning ever new information from those codes because they were so hard to crack. And that intrigued me too. And so you put all that together and you've got the chase of the Berlin Letters.
Awesome. Wow.
What a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
Great story. And it's stuff, you know, personally, I've never heard of this.
I learned so much from this book.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. So much of it that I did. And we'll get into it as we go forward. But yeah, it was crazy how much. I was like, what? I didn't know about this. I didn't know about this.
No.
So thank you for writing this. It's how I like to learn my history with a nice little dose of fiction. You know, that's how
that's my favorite way too.
Yeah. I like it too. And I have to tell you, when I can use fact over fiction, I will every time because it is far more compelling and often more shocking. Mm. I mean, there was stuff in that book I couldn't make up if I wanted to. Wow. I mean, just the fact was so rich and diabolical enough that, you know, why make something up?
Louisa was such a great character. Just a fascinating woman whose job, you know, was to crack codes, but was oblivious to the fallacy of her own history. Was she fun to write for, I imagine?
She was so fun to write. Yeah. And what made her fun to write was that she was impetuous, she was smart, she wanted to know the truth, she was ready to chase the truth. And yet it had been kept from her. And I think that is indicative of the human experience in the sense that we never really fully understand our parents or our grandparents. We don't really understand the time in which they lived and the choices they made, why they made them. And so, yes, her family history is perhaps more complex than some of ours, but maybe not more complex than some of ours. And it was sort of that unfolding because all of those secrets definitely were playing out within the currents in her family. And that is often the way it is in our own families. Currents playing out that we have no idea that are even there. It's just family life. And so to uncover those was really fun. And she was just that go-getter type of woman to do it, you know?
Yeah.
What's ironic is that, you know, we spend our whole lives not understanding our parents, but it's our kids, and we've got a teenager ourselves who's always screaming at us, "You understand me."
I know.
Maybe it's time for us to flip it back on our kids.
Exactly. Right. I don't understand you, and you don't understand me.
That's right. And that's okay.
Right.
You don't want to understand volume. Too much.
Too much.
Don't scratch beneath the surface. Now, and then, yes. So we talk about Louisa, who's got this upbringing that she didn't know about. She's been told lies about what happened to her grandparents. And then just to imagine, you go back to those pictures you saw that inspired you to write this book, to imagine a woman back then and to think about how she as a little girl is lifted over this wall at the last second given. And then just as her mother tries to climb over it, it's just what a heartbreaking way to start.
Yeah. How dare you?
A story.
I know. I mean, I have to tell you, it was heartbreaking for me to start the story that way.
Yeah.
But it was so important for me to not only have the Berlin Wall frame the story, but have it be a character within the story. Mm-hmm. And so it had to start that very morning. And boy, did it start with a heartbreaking bang. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize also how quickly the wall went up. And then, you know, maybe I'm just an idiot. I don't know anything about the Berlin Wall, but you talk about the death strip inside of it and guns and barbed wire and everything. I mean, it sounded like it was something else, huh?
But, you know, that's not unusual, especially from our perspective. We think of it as one wall.
Yeah.
Right.
But by 1989, it was a 10-foot wall. There was a death strip, sometimes 300 feet wide, with metal shards in it. At one point, there were automatic firing weapons. But as I wrote in the book, when the East Germans wanted money from the West Germans, West Germany said, "Yeah, we'll give you the $1 billion, but you have to take away the automatic firing weapons." And they did. But all of that, guard towers, sand strip to track footprints, and then another smaller wall, 6 feet high. So the East Germans could only get to the smaller wall. You know, the big wall that we see on the west side, they couldn't get anywhere near.
Wow.
So, yeah, I know, that's pretty crazy. And most people don't know, it went up in a night. It was called Operation Rose. And when East Germany got permission from Moscow to put up the wall, Ulbricht, who was the head of state at the time, he'd already been purchasing barbed wire from around the world in small enough quantities to not get anyone suspicious.
Wow.
He'd already been prefabricating cement blocks outside the city. And in one morning, that barbed wire's up. And within days, the cement started getting rolled in. So it was very quick.
Wow. Well, I wish we could have found. We were building the addition on the house there. It'd been nice to have some of those construction work.
Sure, yeah.
some of those German crews over here.
I do think about the like medieval fortresses and things like that. It's a similar type of situation.
Yeah.
Not for different reasons, I suppose. I had no idea that there were people in the 80s working on ciphers from the 40s.
Yes.
Did you do like a lot of research on that? Were there women? I know in the World War II, you know, I've read Caitlin's Rose Quote. That's the only information. That's how I get my information.
Sure.
Historical fiction.
Caitlin's Rose Quote.
I didn't know there were women working there.
Yeah. So you are right. During World War II, there were lots of different projects going on. Now, what made the Venona Project pretty special was they were cracking codes of an American ally. Starting in 1943, the USSR was an ally in World War II to the United States and France and Great Britain, the Allies. And so although we had started intercepting all communications when we entered the war in 41, we certainly, you know, should not have been probably opening our allies' mail. But there was a colonel in the U.S. military services who just didn't trust Stalin and got the Venona Project, sort of secreted them away. And it was primarily women, really good at math. Soviet codes were based on incredibly complex math and really good at math. And they started cracking those codes. So, and yes, they kept returning to them because what happened was, is you could crack part of the code, but maybe not the whole code. So after World War II, the FBI got involved and was starting to dig around too. So they would give the Venona Project some information. The project would go back to the codes, corroborate the information, and even new information. So it was this back and forth dialogue that went on for 37 years. And, you know, we know the names of Carl Fuchs, Don Burgess, you know, Guy Burgess, Don McLean, two of the Cambridge Five, Alger Hiss, the Rosenbergs. All of those are spies that the Venona Project uncovered.
Wow, really?
Yeah, primarily women just doing an amazing job.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Did you, how much, now are you a method writer? Did you have to like get a book of ciphers and try to crack it yourself? Oh. You get into
okay,
it?
Okay, I did. Okay,
yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I did, but I did not put it in the book. So I will tell, you know, all listeners, when you read the Berlin letters, I used acrostic ciphers and shift ciphers because all of the Soviet ciphers, number one, they're based on math. And that was going to be a lot of math in this book. And number two, you wouldn't be able to really crack them yourself as you read along. And I thought that'd be more fun. So I did make all my own codes.
Okay.
But I did not make them numerically based.
Right. No, and I like how you like you show the you start showing out the letters in this coded form and then you show the credit. And then I'm like, I'm going back. Okay, this sentence starts with this letter. And
exactly.
Then, yeah,
right. Right. Yeah. So I did want to make that so readers could enjoy that. I thought that'd be a lot of fun.
Good.
So there you go.
It certainly was.
Yeah.
Now.
Oh, I was curious about you have some interesting videos on your website detailing your trip to Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
Was it important? I've been to Berlin. I was in Berlin in like 1992 when I was a teenager with another friend. And I think the wall had not been down very long at that point. And it was very interesting to see because it was still parts of it were still there. And it was an odd feeling is what I would say. Was it important for you to visit Berlin when you were writing this book?
It was. Yeah. It was really important for me. I'd never been to Berlin before. And you can see differences from the East and the West, even now 30 years later. But what was really important is I can look on a Google map and I could lead Louisa through the streets and I could do the same with Harris. But, for instance, there's a moment that Louisa is running down Karl Marx Allee to the Finisterrum in the middle of the Alexanderplatz. And I knew that that was a straight line run, but only when I was feet on the ground did I realize the magnitude of Soviet architecture down that alley and how the Finisterrum is centered in the center. And it was just this huge, like, we are the Soviet Union and we are impressive and we are an empire. You know what I mean? And you don't emotional, like, oh my goodness, this is massive. And you don't also get the, this is massive and this is where the tourists were. And if you go two blocks off, this is where the people lived and it's very, very different. And I didn't experience that until I was there, nor could I see on a map just how stark and huge the Stasi headquarters were on Malignenstrasse. So that was incredible. So yeah, being there made all the difference in the world.
The scale. Yeah. It's hard to appreciate the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. Also probably just the overall vibe, the atmosphere,
yes.
Whatever that is. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. You got to soak it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do mention in the book and more, which was really a lot of heartbreaking stuff in here, but maybe none more so the Soviets who would go down and take buildings and like destroy the wonderful architecture detailings. So everything is just the same and the same and the same and everything has to. Oh, it's awful.
So sad.
And, And that was on a tour in Berlin. We got a tour and we were walking around and someone said, you know, look up to that store. That story is called the Bel-Etage because mm-hmm. it's a beautiful floor to live on. And at one point, and he would point out in the West how the, you know, the beautiful ornamentation was still there and how in the East it was gone. And so it really, that I would not have been able to find, I don't That's think, true. From a book. But yeah. it was so visual that it was really neat to learn about it and then put it in the book.
Yep. Yeah. Now, something about the Berlin Wall that I don't know why I didn't think about, but it never occurred to me, probably because I'm just reading too much fiction and not enough. So I'm glad I found your book. Is that it was more like a tool to keep the citizens in than to keep people out. I mean, nowadays you hear certain former presidents and so on rail about putting up walls on the border and walls on the got to keep them out. But this Berlin Wall
it goes both ways.
It goes both ways. Right. Yeah. We don't want people influenced by Western way of thinking. Right.
And that is true. It was called an anti-fascist protection barrier. Oh, so that was the propaganda in the East was, hey, we cannot let this horrible Western culture into our pure culture. And that's how they tried to sell it. Mm. But the bottom line is between 1945 and 1961, 2.6 million East Germans would go through Berlin, walk across the street into West Berlin and leave.
Wow.
Their economy was collapsing. The very month before the Berlin Wall went up, July of 1961, 20,000 walked across the street.
Wow.
And that's what it was. You may have had to show your papers, but you were basically walking across the street. And so it was destroying the economy.
Mm.
They were like, nope, we're not going to have this anymore. But of course, they couldn't tell people that, you know, you're destroying our economy. They had to say, oh, we're protecting you. This is going to keep us pure, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Wow. So it was the propaganda, but it really was. They had to stop the hemorrhaging of citizens leaving.
That's really interesting.
That is interesting. Mm. So in the book, Luisa's grandmother worked under Stalin as a rubble woman. I'm putting that, which no one can see but you. in Berlin. And this was, I've never heard about this. It's women who are, I guess, subjected to incredible physical labor. When did you hear about that? And I'm assuming as soon as you heard about it, you're like, I got to include this.
Well, to be honest, I did not know about the summer of 1945. Hmm. So when Yalta was signed and the Soviet Union was given basically half of Berlin and the other three countries, France, England, and the United States, the other half of Berlin, the Soviet Union made a race across Germany and into Berlin to basically seize the city, seize their portion of it. And they arrived in April of 45, I believe, and the Allies did not arrive until fall of 1945. Mm-hmm. And in that time period, they pretty much destroyed everything in the East. There was rubble everywhere. Quite frankly, the stories of the rats and the bodies, the destruction, you also have to remember, as awful as this sounds, they were ruthless because they were very angry with the Germans for Hitler, for turning on them. Remember, Stalin and Hitler were allies at one point, for turning on them and invading the USSR.
Wow.
So they wanted payback and they weren't kind about it. And so, yes, the women were called rubble women and they basically were clearing the streets of rubble and heavy boulders and everything else when the Soviets would bring the buildings down.
Wow. Mm.
And so, yes, it was back-breaking, horrible work.
Wow.
And there are stories about, you know, canals filled with bodies and blood running in the streets. And
wow.
Yeah, it was the research was pretty harrowing at times.
Hmm.
Is that when you start going down those rabbit holes? I mean, how do you know when you're just like, I can't, this is something that I just can't, I can't go further, or I have to include this, or I have to exclude this? You know, what's your thought process?
There are a few things that I wanted to include, such as she worked as a rubble woman, but that's as far as I go.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you'll remember, There was just a comment that the Washington Post reporter told Louisa about what many of the Soviet soldiers did to German women.
Mm.
That's all I wanted to say about it.
Just enough, yeah.
But to be honest, I did think those things had to be acknowledged in some way because they were massive. They were huge. But to just acknowledge that it happened and it absolutely changed someone's personality or psyche, and it story comes first for me. But those two little facts absolutely affected Louise's grandmother.
Yeah.
So therefore, I wanted to bring them out, acknowledge them as part of history. Yes, they affect her. They affected Louisa's mom, Monica. And I sort of, you know, that's one reason why she was paralyzed at that barbed wire. The soldier spoke Russian, not German.
Yes.
And so it's those little details that I hope do give someone an idea of, you know, without laying it all out there, just alluding to big things that happened in history.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, often less is more, you know, we have to happen off stage is often worse than our imagination.
But
on a lighter note, I do enjoy how you got a lot of movie references in here, especially back in the 80s to help us, you know, establish where we are. And it really, you know, as a big movie guy myself, I did enjoy the Dead Poets Society reference. Working Girl was another one. So like when you're trying to root a scene in a certain time and place, are you just like pulling out your favorite movies, or how does that work for you?
Oh yeah, music, movies, books, all of it to create cultural touch points. And then, you know what I do want to say, we've talked about some serious things. And Berlin Letters obviously has some serious moments, but it is a light book. It is a chase.
Yes.
And there are a lot of fun movies. And by the way, don't forget the clothing. I mean, remember the big silk bow?
Like,
I wore something like that back then. But I did. And and then Carrie with her maternity dress with the polka dots on it. I was not pregnant in the 80s, but that's what you wore.
Horrible fashion, absolutely horrible.
And hair, big hair.
Odd. The big hair.
Yeah, the shoulder pads.
Yes, the shoulder pads.
And there's a great, very exciting scene in the book that involves a punk rock band. I mean, was that must have been fun to write too, huh?
Okay, that was so fun. That was my nod. In many ways, that was my nod to Pretty Woman. Do you remember, and I don't say, Pretty Woman wasn't out at the time, but do you remember when Julia Roberts goes into the store and she gets transformed?
Yes.
I mean, that's what Louisa, she basically transformed into a punk rocker.
Yeah.
Yes.
But researching punk rock was so eye-opening for me, and I had so much fun with it because it wasn't what we thought. I mean, it wasn't what it was in London and New York. Punk rock in East Germany was, you know, basically a shot to the regime.
Right.
Like over here, it was complaining. It was a little bit of discontent, but it wasn't going to get anybody killed.
Right.
It was more fashion choices here.
Yes.
In a lot of ways. Yeah.
Those kids were making choices about and standing by them. I mean, getting arrested constantly, interrogated, body cavity searches, all sorts of stuff that they went through to continually say, I will not follow your rules.
Yeah.
It was incredible to read about.
Right. Well, I thought that was just a brilliant way to have and to use the punk rock scene in the book itself.
Now, are you listening to? Did you listen to?
Okay, I did. I did listen to.
Yeah. How much? How long did it last?
She's very little bit of the Sex Pistols. But
yeah, it's more about the movement itself than it is about the music. You know.
Yeah. Yes. And to me, it's the stylistic look too.
For sure.
Also,
I
thought you did such a great job, though, capturing that, like the paranoia and the fear was being felt, you know, in Berlin, and especially with Harris. I think there's one chapter in particular. He's searching his apartment looking for bugs, wondering if he's under surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Was this just something that was common back then? It's common. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Extremely common. In fact, in the 1980s. The Stasi had basically one out of eight citizens co-opted into being a snitch.
Wow.
So, you know, that means that if you're living on a floor of an apartment building, probably two or three or more of your neighbors are watching you. And who knows, maybe even some of your family is watching you. That was not unheard of either. And a lot of that came out when the Stasi files began to be opened in 1992, people would go look in their file and find out that, oh my goodness, my niece was spying on me, or oh my goodness, my best friend was spying on me.
Wow.
Shocking stuff. But yes, there was this ever-present paranoia and fear, fully justified.
What a terrible way to live. Really terrible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gosh.
All right, Catherine, it is now time for our segment that we call Quick Six. Now, these are six
quick
questions, but you can take your time with them. That's fine.
Okay.
These questions, which we find out just a little bit more, it scratched the surface. Here we go. What is, number one, what is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Last show I watched or binged. Okay, so I binged The Queen's Gambit twice.
Oh, twice.
I honestly, I thought that final episode was about the most perfect episode. Mm. I just loved it.
Yeah.
So, okay. When you binge something twice, I think that.
Yeah. I was thinking about that show the other
Amazing.
Night.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Really well done.
Been kind of wanting to revisit it. Yeah. What fictional world or place would you like to visit? You get to come back if it's dangerous.
Okay, so no, this is actually pretty easy for me, Narnia.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I bet that's such a rote answer, but I would see Pevensey and give Aslan a huge hug. But just, you know, I would like to go to Narnia while the Pevensey children are on the thrones at Caer Paribel.
Yeah.
Because that's when Narnia was thriving.
Okay. There you go. I like you. You got a little deep.
I got a little specific there.
Narnia, also Middle Earth is a very popular answer for that.
I would bet.
Yeah.
How about this? Give us one of your favorite. Now we talked about Working Girl and Dead Poets Society. Give us one of your favorite movies of all time.
Favorite movies of all time. Oh my goodness. This is one I don't think about very often.
These are the tough ones.
I'm really more of like a movie in the moment person. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Okay, so I will tell you, and I didn't even know that other people love it. I loved The 100-Foot Journey. I love food in movies and I find it so sensorial and I love that story. So That probably would be on my top five. So would The Lord of the Rings, since we're mentioning Middle Earth.
Yeah.
Would too. So would a cheesy little The Holiday, Christmas.
I love The Holiday.
I love The Holiday.
Love The Holiday. Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. Just coming out with lots of movies.
Good.
I want that cottage.
Okay, so I want The Cottage and I want Cameron Diaz's Kashmir.
Oh yeah, I'll take that.
I mean, her sweater sets and everything in that movie is fantastic.
No,
Kashmir.
Yeah, it's done really well. How about this one's? I think a little harder. How about one of your favorite books?
Okay, so Jane Austen's Persuasion.
Okay,
Pretty much my all-time favorite book. That said, I'm trying to think of others that I return to again and again. Like to be a favorite, you have to return to it again and again, right?
Absolutely.
Like, okay. So that one. Now that said, I have not returned to it yet, but I thought Maggie O'Farrell's Hamnet was incredibly well written. Yeah. I thought her prose was spectacular. Yeah. So I haven't returned to it, but I do remember that being.
It's new. Give it a couple years. You know,
Exactly. I'll go back to it. That's exactly right.
How about this, Catherine? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Oh my goodness. Oh, yes, I do.
Oh.
Good.
Wait. Hang on. Mm-hmm. I want to say, because I've actually done this several times in karaoke, is it Phil Collins' Can't Buy Me Love? No, is it? Yeah, Can't Hurry Love.
Can't Hurry Love.
That's it.
Oh, yeah.
Can't Buy Me Love. Can't Hurry Love. Oh, you just got to wait. I can't believe I'm singing. Oh, my God.
Cover of the Supremes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
But I always knew as a kid his version of it. Do you know what I mean?
Like that was a big hit. Yeah, I remember when that was. Yeah.
But I just remember when he came out with that. So anyway, there you go.
Like I know the Supremes version more.
I remember that one. That was a big
one. I want to listen to his version.
Top 40.
Now. Yeah.
Back when I used to listen to Casey Kasem do the top 40. Yeah. That was
exactly. There you go.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's really funny. Last question. What book are you currently reading?
At the moment, I'm reading a advanced reader copy of Madeline Martin's new book called The Book Lover's Library. And it won't come out, I don't believe, until maybe fall of 2024. But I am so, that's the great thing about being a writer, is that people use their books way in advance. And you get to have all this fun early. So I'm really enjoying that one. I'm also finishing up a book that is equally parts fascinating and terrifying. Mm. It's called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. And it is, I wrote the man's name down because I keep forgetting it. It is by Peter, I think it's Zihan. I could be totally mispronouncing that, but he's a geopolitical analyst. Oh. And he's talking about sort of, you know, global commerce and what happens when it all breaks down from a really high level view. And it's just kind of interesting, the globalization and...
That's terrifying.
It is. It's absolutely terrifying.
When but you said it, I hope it was fiction.
I know. I wish it was fiction too, actually. But it's both terrifying and fascinating because he's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Like the connections he makes and the things he knows globally, you're just sitting there like, okay, you're really smart. And this is impressive. So there you go.
That's good. Yeah.
Excellent. Very good.
Great recommendation.
Well, speaking of good recommendations, we will be recommending the Berlin Letters. Really, really enjoyed it. And thanks for coming on and chatting with us. A lot of fun.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is great.
Of course.
Good luck with the book deal.
Indeed.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. The Inside Flap. All right, there you go. Thanks so much to Catherine Ray talking about her book, The Berlin Letters. Check it out. It is really good and it is available now. Let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Flora Medicus.
She comes from Silver Spoon.
I heard this song on the radio the other day.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, I thought Laura Medicus, had discovered this.
Thought you were the only one who
And
knew
then
about
I'm
this
driving
song.
Around and I got KBCO on out here.
Yeah.
And Robin Hart, this DJ that I like, she says, Red Clay Strays, Wondering Why.
Wow.
I was like, darn it.
Did you break into a cold sweat because you hadn't written your book review yet and you thought you were getting ready to read it?
Well, it's obviously the Inside Flap influence.
It is the Inside
That's
Flap,
right.
I know.
That's right. The power of
Sometimes
the Inside Flap.
I will think that I independently discover a song just through different means. And it turns out like everyone else is experiencing the song at the same time. Yeah. So that's what I've learned. And it's disappointing because I'd like to be a trailblazer, but I'm not.
The trendsetter. Not so much.
No, this book is also not trendsetting.
Oh, all
this right. is a book that came out this year, but it has already over 100,000 reviews on Goodreads.
Wow.
It is 4.71.
Stop it.
Whoa. Yeah. Isn't that crazy? With that many reviews. It's called The Women by Kristen Hanna. So like many people, I am a Kristen Hanna fan.
Sure.
She's an incredibly skilled historical fiction writer. She gets the details right, but you know, we read different things and you can get the details right, but you got to know how to tell a great story.
Sure.
And this woman does. So this book is set in Vietnam and it's about a 20-year-old nursing student who enlists in the Army Corps of Nurses in 1965 and she gets shipped out to Vietnam. She's following the footsteps of her brother who was shipped out with the Navy. Frankie is short for Frances. She's an upper middle class young woman from Coronado Island in San Diego, which is kind of interesting. Very specific.
Yeah.
She's a privileged white woman, you know, of that generation, that 1965. So you can kind of imagine.
Okay.
She's completely unprepared for what she's about to experience in Vietnam as a combat nurse. So the first half of this book is absolutely incredible. It details her airplane ride out. Basically, we're with Frankie from the moment she enlists, she flies out, we get on her on the helicopter with her out into this jungle, and then it's basically a descent into hell that really was active duty in Vietnam. And I could not put it down. I've never read about a woman in Vietnam.
Well, that's the thing. You see, there are so many movies and books
about men.
Boys, yeah. Men, young
yeah,
men.
Young men.
I mean, so young.
Yeah.
And I've read many of them. I've watched many. I love,
yeah.
You know, Vietnam War literature and movies, but I have never, I can't
first
even
one.
Think of anyone.
And we know from
there.
MASH.
Yeah,
that there right. were in Hot Lips Houlihan.
Hot Lips Houlihan.
There were
there.
Women
yes,
as combat nurses.
Yes,
wasn't it the Korean War MASH?
Oh, that's right. That
oh,
was
that
the
was
Korean
the Korean
War.
War.
That wasn't even
Andrew.
Vietnam.
I'm such an idiot.
That was the Korean War.
So then I guess we don't know that. No. But as a young child, I thought that MASH was set in Vietnam because I just didn't know.
Or, yeah,
that's what I thought.
And I, you know, I watched MASH as a kid, but
yeah.
I couldn't say I like knew it all at that time.
Yeah.
Which conflict it actually
right.
was.
Oh,
yeah,
really
I just assumed.
That.
I isn't that interesting? I guess I didn't realize that. Yeah, so it was. This was absolutely amazing to read about Vietnam from this woman's experience, from her perspective, I mean. So the sounds and the smells of Vietnam, the fear, the randomness of it, of being in the jungle, it, just all-encompassing. And if you want to read just fantastic historical fiction set in Vietnam, the first half of this book is a must read. And I think it'll go down in the canon of Vietnam
yeah.
literature. So the second half of this book is all about the aftermath of Vietnam for Frankie. So she comes home like everybody did,
yeah.
a different person than she was when she left. You know, she's a woman in Vietnam. People like to tell her there were no women in Vietnam. Like if she tries to help to get services, mental health services, they also like to tell her to get over it. And she does try. So I found this book very much a before and an after of what war does to a human being. And the war part, just to be frank, was engrossing, enthralling, entertaining, page turning. And then the after part was sometimes hard to read because we all have seen the Vietnam vets and how they were kind of treated afterwards
yeah.
in our country. And it's a little tougher of a read than the exciting combat stuff that was in the first part. Just making sure you know it. It's an incredible book. And it just was great because, you know, I was born after the Vietnam was over and didn't make it into my particular high school history books. Didn't learn a lot about.
Yeah,
did
no,
you guys
it would
learn
always
about it?
No, because it would always be the end of the year, and we'd
yes.
still be wrapping up World War II, and then they'd be
we
like,
would.
"Oh, by the way, we got into this conflict in Vietnam,
yeah.
and
yeah.
you know, we didn't have a lot of time to cover it. But
yeah.
You got any questions about the Vietnam War? No, we're ready for summer vacation. All right,
yeah.
Have a good summer.
Yeah, I read The Things They Carried.
Yes.
That Tom Cruise movie came out
Born on the 4th of July.
That man is mentioned in this book because she
Ron
goes
Kovich.
Yeah, she goes to a protest in DC that he was at. This is a great book. It's an eye-opening book and it's called The Women by Kristen Hanna.
It sounds amazing.
It's really good.
I really want to read that one.
I think you'd love it.
That one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see. But my book this week,
Dave Medicus. It's a bonfire.
I did not hear this on the radio.
No, you're not going to hear this on the radio.
Heavily edited.
Yeah, for sure. So my book this week is The Last Ranger by Peter Heller. Now, I know Laura,
I love Peter Heller.
An author you love and
I really
love as well. We've recommended his books on this
I'm
show
jealous
before.
That you read it before me.
The River and The Guide were a couple of his books. This one, The Last Ranger, is set in Yellowstone National Park and focuses on the character of Wren, R-E-N, a park ranger there.
Hmm.
And Heller, as he does, listen, in all his books, what he does really well is he writes about nature.
He does.
So well.
The outdoors.
Such a vivid
He's a
picture.
Colorado writer.
He is a Colorado. One day we got to get him on the show.
I don't know if we can, but we can try.
Well, I remember we had CJ Box on the podcast.
That's maybe how we reel him in.
And we should do it that way because
yeah.
he was talking about how he thinks. He was like, well, Peter thinks he's a better fisherman than I am. But, you know. There's,
okay,
there's
we can reel him in that way.
Little, yeah. Oh, I see what you did there. Reel him in. Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. I didn't mean to.
Nice.
I wondered why Andrew perked up.
Yeah. Andrew loves his puns.
He did.
He also, he does something which I enjoy with this kind of book is that he's not in a hurry to get the story going. we kind of, it's a slow burn.
They are,
we
yeah.
get to meet the characters just like nature. It meanders, like a nice creek going through the woods. It meanders, it rambles along. And we get to know Ren. We get to see what his life is like as a park ranger, all the annoying things he has to do, like deal with people who like to get too close to the moose and endanger their lives or the moose's lives, or campers who are fighting over a camping spot. But the book doesn't tell the story of the tourists. However, this book focuses on the locals and a kind of a secret group of them who are banding together to fight against Ren and his desire to protect the national park, where all the locals want to do is use the land and, you know, really just hunt the animals.
Hunt and fish. Yeah.
Hunt and fish and do all that kind of things. They don't believe in
sure.
that this should be nationally protected
okay.
kind of land. So when Ren one day discovers his friend Hilly, who has been trapped in a bear trap, he knows that these are the people responsible. And he kind of figures, well, it's about time he should do something about it. I love this character. I love how Heller writes about the outdoors. There's no one better than him. And I love how the story just is in no rush to get where it needs to go. But yet there is still plenty of action in it throughout along the way. It does an excellent job at explaining the importance of the balance of nature and why it was so important to reintroduce wolves to Yellowstone. I mean, there's a whole... a couple of pages where he just details how nature works. It's just absolutely amazing. And I'm not even going to try to explain it. Read it and you'll be like, oh yeah, okay. That's why wolves need to be there. And that's why there is a very, very, very delicate balance of nature. But it goes all the way down to a little tiny mosquito. And now we just need to keep things in place and as they are. And
balanced.
When we lose one thing, we lose 20 different things at the same time. Yes, there is a very, very delicate balance there that we want to keep in place. This is a good one. I love this one. The Last Ranger by Peter Heller. Check it out. All right, Andrew.
Andrew Dowd.
I may have heard this one on the radio once or twice.
Once yeah, or twice. Sure. Long time ago, though.
Yeah. Sure.
Not recently.
So this book I'm reviewing this week is one of the most unique, original books I've ever read. Certainly recommended. So it is a sci-fi dystopian book. The book is called Plastic by Scott Gild.
Okay.
Now, Scott Gild is a songwriter. He is the lead guitarist for the group New Collisions. I think I get that right. And he also has this, like, you know, PhD in literature.
Oh, wow.
In writing.
Huh.
And I, you know, this is not the easiest book to read, right? This book is so different. The book, you know, is a bit of a challenge to read. But if you're looking for a different perspective, if you're looking for something different, then maybe this is the book for you. And so this book, it basically is, the main character is Erin. She is a plastic girl living in a plastic world.
Oh.
Okay.
Hello, Barbie.
Yeah, I can see.
What's up, Barbie?
And I do think this would make a great movie, and Margot Robbie would make a great Erin.
Margot Robbie would make a great anything.
But she's not going to win any awards, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, but I think we're
think we're on the same page.
We're used to that.
We're getting that.
For now, yeah. Yeah. So...
But this book just came out last month.
Yeah,
look at Andrew hot being off current.
Hot off the presses. So
we all have current books, though, this week.
Yes,
we do. Good for us.
Yeah, and I would say...
I'm going to give us a ding just for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And this book will make you think. And so Erin basically... And what I would say is, I wonder, in terms of how he's writing this, and there's some difficult subject matter here in terms of, you know... Let's just say terrorism, you know, what the world has basically, and I don't want to say evolve, because evolve is, I think, progress, but I guess it's devolved, like what the world has devolved into in terms of this book. You know, and I think it's good to read something like that, you know, in terms of contrast to where we are. And so Erin basically is plastic, but she is still human. But I wonder... like, is this style of writing sort of like the modern fable, right? If this book really goes in such a place, and it's basically saying some very bold things, and it's making some bold statements, that, you know, is Scott basically made it the characters plastic? Because if he had done this and he'd written this and it was humans, it would be an even, let's say, stronger statement. So maybe, you know, is he making it the characters plastic, basically saying, you know, trying to kind of, you know what I mean? Sort of like, you know, back in the day of the fables were trying to say something about humanity without coming out and saying it directly.
Yeah.
Right. And so I wonder if
a lot of horror does that too.
Yeah. So yeah. I think it's sort of a modern fable. And so, Aaron is, you know, and I don't know if you call it the protagonist, maybe you can call it the protagonist, but I would say everything in this book is open to interpretation.
Wow.
Interesting. But basically, she is definitely a victim of the society. She has suffered her share of tragedy. You know, her fiancé has been killed in a terrorist attack. Her parents killed in terrorist attacks. She's trying to better. Still, she's trying to manage day to day. She's still trying to better her position in life, to better her situation. She's trying to study, to take an exam. You know, she's trying to do more. She's trying to move on from, you know, her fiance that was killed. You know, and that's, I mean, that's what this book, that's what this book is about.
Hmm.
Now, also something, and this book it basically, it takes terrorism and it turns terrorism up to where, like, there's terrorism everywhere. Like, you know, we think we've got, like, bombings and different things going on now. I mean, this book basically turns the dial up on that.
Hmm.
So it takes terrorism to 11.
Wow.
Really?
You know, in terms of the book. And that's, you know, I mean, it's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, and there's parts of this book where, you know, a certain character turns towards terrorism. You know, and that's an interesting, you know. Oh, and so the way this book is written, too, the characters, they talk in what I would say is simple, imperfect English.
Hmm.
And that takes a little bit of getting used to. The chapters are written as episodes. And there are also some songs written into the book.
Huh. Book.
And so what you also find is if you go on to, I went on to Apple Music and I looked for Scott Gild and Plastic, and I found that, you know, there's an actual album that's been released.
Wow.
To basically accompany the book. But, you know, Plastic, Scott Gild, you can look to see some of the songs, and Laura and I were listening to a couple of those later. But, you know, I really wonder how much of an altered state Scott Gild was in when he wrote this book. Because,
oh, really?
I mean, some of this book seems like one big acid trip.
Huh.
Or actually, no, let me take that back. It seems like multiple sequential acid trips.
Wow. I'm on Goodreads and it's over 4 stars. Not very many ratings, but it sounds like it just came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said,
yeah, people are saying that this book will turn your brain inside out.
No, and it does. It really does. It certainly did that to me. Maybe for the better.
Yeah.
But I don't know that this book like is for everybody, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but. The book is called Plastic. It is by Scott Gild, and it is unlike anything
that is so
I have ever picked up.
That is very interesting.
All right. Well,
very interesting.
Take intriguing. A look at that if you want to turn your brain inside out, which means it's time for the
audiobook of the week.
And my pick this week is, look, I've got another one of my, I love this guy so much. If you're looking for a little horror, Bentley Little is your guy.
Oh.
This book is called The Mailman and it is read by David Stifel. Look, I know you're not a huge Bentley Little.
I like his books. I had trouble reading them because they are horror.
They are.
And they're the type of horror that
normal people get
it's
trapped.
It's regular, everyday people.
People like you or I.
That get into terrible situations that they cannot control. Yes.
Well, let me tell you about the
and it's my worst nightmare.
Get trapped in terrible situations.
All right.
So it's another instant classic from Bentley Little. This one starring a terrifying mailman with the power to change the mail. The story begins. Now I loved it immediately because as a teacher, The story begins on the first day of summer vacation, and our main character is a high school English teacher.
Oh, wow.
His name is Billy.
Oh.
Yeah, and he's Billy's sitting around, and he's thinking about the project. You know, of course, every summer
he's got a project.
Got a project.
Oh, yeah.
He's thinking about finally putting together a little shed in the backyard.
Nice. That's a good, okay? That's a good summer project.
Suddenly, indeed, news breaks that the local mailman that everybody loved, one of these mailmen, and we used to have one here.
Oh, we had a great one, Sean.
Sean. I love Sean. I don't even know who our new mailman is.
You know, he's actually friendly. I don't know what his name is. He's very friendly, though.
I've been around when he's around. But Sean, I would chat with all the time.
Yeah, everyone loves Sean.
Nuggets fan. He'd have bones for your dogs.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Yeah.
So this is this kind of guy. Well, it turns out that he has committed suicide.
Oh.
And the whole town is grieving. And they all show up for the guy's funeral along with a stranger at the funeral, a skinny, pale, red-haired man. And it turns out that this stranger, well, he's the new mailman. And he's going to replace this guy that everybody loves. He's a very strange fellow. He speaks in an odd, robotic fashion. But at first, things start looking up for Billy and his family. They start getting good news in the mail. They start getting checks. They get money from relatives they haven't heard from and birthday cards. But strangely enough, they are not receiving any bills in the mail. And turns out the whole community are not getting any bills in the mail. And things suddenly turn south in a hurry when they start receiving hate-filled messages from people, letters from people they thought were their friends. And this is something that is a trend that recurs all throughout the community. It is, listen, this is a bizarre story that slowly
gets... His stories are bizarre.
More, yeah, and they get more and more bizarre as they go along. And as it does here, it is wildly inventive. It is unique. It's a creepy story from an author who has been called, quote, Stephen King without a conscience.
I can see that.
And I think you can see
sure.
that. Oh, yeah. Let's take a listen to a clip.
Yeah.
This is The Mailman by Bentley Little, read by David Stifel.
Trisha frowned. What are you talking about? What is he doing? Tell him I don't appreciate it at all. Don't appreciate what? Trisha stared at him. Todd, tell me what's going on here. I don't know what you're talking about. His reserve broke. He smiled at her as he wrapped the fish, and there was sadness in the smile. I know you don't. Todd, I believe you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. He gestured around the empty store. You're my first customer today. What's wrong? She asked. She leaned forward over the counter. Is it the mail? His face grew stony, cold. That'll be $3.50, he said. Todd? $3.50. She paid for the fish and walked out of the store. As she backed up in the parking lot, she saw him standing in the doorway, staring after her. It looked as though he was crying.
Audiobook of the week.
All right, there you go. Oh, yes, Andrew. Breaking news whenever
feels. Have any of his books been turned into movies?
I don't know.
It's a movie. You would not want to see one of these movies, Andrew.
That's what I want. That's what I want.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
I don't think. I think if they were, they'd be like cult classics.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
They would be very popular.
They are.
Very cult.
It's a kind of book, though, once you start it, you can't stop
reading it.
And then you think, it's just stressful. Yes. It's very, very stressful.
Anyway, thank you so much to listen to our show.
Hi, Bentley.
Thanks to Catherine Ray. My name is Dan Manicus. See you next time.
Adios.
Excelsior.
Why do you need that? Why do you need that?